History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. Ask a few questions, take some time and listen, and really prepare to be amazed by what you hear. Our goal has always been to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves really inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you were anywhere near a television this week or even just engaged, even minimally, on social media, surely you caught some coverage of the 80th anniversary of The Longest Day. The numbers are still staggering. More than 2,500 American lives lost on just that one day, June 6, 1944. And by the end of the Battle of Normandy, more than 73,000 Allied troops made the ultimate sacrifice, and more than twice that many more were wounded. Quite a few American World War II veterans were there for the anniversary, taken by groups like Forever Young Veterans or the Best Defense Foundation. Several vets who've shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes were among them. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can find a link to the entire video of the official commemoration. Here's a brief excerpt of what America's Commander-in-Chief had to say.
Monday, June 5th, 1944. The evil Hitler's Third Reich was devastating the world. Nazi Germany had subjugated the once free nations of Europe through brute force, lies, and twisted ideology of racial superiority. Millions of Jews murdered in the Holocaust. Millions of others killed by bombs, bullets, bloody warfare. Hitler and those with him thought democracies were weak, that the future belonged to dictators. Here, on the coast of Normandy, the battle between freedom and tyranny would be joined. Here, on that June morning, the testing was at hand. President Macron, Mrs. Macron, Secretary Austin, Secretary Blinken, distinguished guests, most of all, our honored veterans who met that test of ages to that moment 80 years ago today. On behalf of the American people, and as Commander-in-Chief, it's the highest honor to be able to salute you here in Normandy. Once more, all of you, God love you. Winston Churchill called what happened here, quote, the greatest, most complicated operation ever, end of quote. After years of planning, Operation Overlord was ready to launch. The Supreme Commander of the Allies, Dwight D. Eisenhower, waited. The largest force ever of its kind, built by 12 nations, men, guns, planes, naval craft of every description waited. The world, captive and free, waited. Finally, Eisenhower's forecaster said there was a window in the weather. It would open briefly on Tuesday, the 6th of June. The general weighed the options and gave the order. At dawn, the Allies would strike. The great crusade to free Europe from tyranny would begin. That night, General Eisenhower drove to the English town of Newbury to visit paratroopers of the 101st Airborne. There were men from all over America. It was estimated that 80% of them would be killed within hours. That was the estimate. But they were brave, they were resolute, and they were ready. One soldier told General Eisenhower, quote, don't worry, sir, the 101st is on the job. Everything will be taken care of. That's what he said. And because of their courage and their resolve, because of the courage and resolve of their allies, it was taken care of. From the sea and sky, nearly 160,000 Allied troops descended on Normandy. Many, to state the obvious, never came home. Many survived that longest day, kept on fighting for months until victory was finally won. And a few, a notable band of brothers, are here with us today. Kenneth Blaine Smith is here. On that day, under heavy artillery fire, he operated a rangefinder and radar on the first American ship to arrive at Normandy's coast, providing direct gunfire support for the Rangers scaling the cliffs of Pointe du Hoc on their daring mission to take out the German batteries.
President Biden proceeded to single out by name a few D-Day survivors present. French President Emmanuel Macron presented the French Legion of Honor Medal to some American veterans who helped liberate his homeland. So many tributes, so many emotional moments, and we'll talk more about some more recent developments on our next episode. But for today, we want you to hear what D-Day was like through the memories of men who were there 80 years ago, like Jerry Deitch, an 18-year-old from the Big Apple who came ashore on Utah Beach in the early morning hours of June 6, 1944, with Naval Combat Demolition Unit 30.
But Omaha Beach was tough. They ran against cliffs, and the Germans were above, just throwing everything at them down the cliffs. We came in on regular landing crafts, you know. We got off LSDs, and we got on smaller boats.
Like LCVPs or rubber boats?
Yeah. Not rubber boats, no. LCVP. It was cold. It was cold. And it was rough. The weather was rough. As a matter of fact, I remember, and it's going to be in my mind for years to come, going down the ropes. The boats were coming up because of the waves, coming up and then dropping maybe 25 feet, coming up and dropping. And the guys that were there before me down in the boats saying, not yet, not yet, leave go and drop. And they were ready to catch you if the boat was going down. I had two guys catch me, you know. Because of all the gear that I had on me.
Yeah, what were you carrying?
I was carrying a knapsack. I was carrying a rifle. I was carrying a mess kit. And, of course, I had heavy combat boots and a heavy uniform on. And I know that on my back, that was 30 pounds that I was carrying.
And you're not the biggest guy in the world.
I was the shortest one in the unit. Everybody was between 5'10 and 6'4.
And you're 5'7?
5'7.
And you carrying explosives?
No, what we did was we unloaded the boat. It was just, there were three rookies, myself and two others, and they left us to carry all the explosives ashore. Well, out of, I think there were four of us. Out of the four, two ran, and I and another guy, we carried them ashore and came back, carried them ashore, and we were in 2 foot of water. Of course, I couldn't land all the way.
So this is Utah Beach on June 6, 1944. And what's happening around you? That's what you're doing. But what are you seeing? What are you hearing?
I saw a tank come on just before us. One tank. And I saw people huddling behind the tank, not realizing that we're taking cover. I went ahead and got up to the tank and put my hands out like it was cold. And I thought they were warming themselves. No. And somebody behind me says, keep low, because German 88s were pounding the beach. As the tide was coming in, they were coming closer and closer.
And you saw American servicemen who'd already been killed.
Yeah, had already been killed and getting killed. And the guy next to me in my outfit was killed immediately. He didn't even know what hit him.
How far away was he from you?
Oh, I would say 2 feet. Maybe less than that. He was almost standing next to me.
So how did you experience that?
I don't know. I right now and afterwards, I think I was in shock. I didn't think about it. I thought, going through my mind, this is what I have to do. This is what I have to do. This is the way I have to set up the explosives. This is what I'm looking for.
But you're there, and he's next to you, and then a moment later, he's gone?
Yeah. And you want to know something? It didn't hit me. It didn't hit me. When I got to the hospital 3 days later, that's when it hit me. It hit me that all these guys that I trained with were gone. Soldiers that I didn't know, that they had to be not much older than me.
And you're just 18, yeah. And you mentioned unloading all the explosives and the supplies for your unit. What about the rest of that day? Because it's been famously called the longest day. What were you doing the rest of June 6th, okay, and how long did it feel for you?
We were busy clearing up the beaches with obstacles that were in the way of the guys coming down. We did that without even thinking, and we cleared everything away. Then we had a pillbox that was about, I would say, a quarter of a mile from where we were, and maybe it was a little less than that. And we went ahead and put explosives around there. Nobody, we didn't see anybody. And then we ducked back about 100 yards back, and we saw them coming out, Germans coming out with their hands raised, surrendering. We don't know how many were killed.
So did you blow the pillbox or no?
We blew it, yeah. We gave ourselves 10 minutes and we blew it. 10 minutes to get out of the way, get the hell out of the way.
So it was after you detonated the explosives that they came running out?
Yeah, they came running out. How many were in there, how many were killed, I don't know. But they came out and my commanding officer took prisoners and turned them over to the infantry right away. I don't know how many.
And before that, when you said, you know, for the next several hours you were clearing obstructions on the beach, does that mean you're setting explosives on those obstructions?
Explosives, yeah. They were obstacles in the way, yeah.
Like those famous tank obstructions we see?
Yeah, and telemines. There was mines on posts.
This is pretty dangerous work, Jerry.
Yeah, but I was pretty young, 18 guys. You know, 18-year-old is indestructible.
But you're surrounded by chaos, by death, by destruction. And none of that slowed you down or fazed you or gave you pause?
No, you know when it bothered me? When I was in a hospital for 3 nights. I slept the first night. I was dead tired. But after that, I was up most of the night. On my mind was, I'm never going to see my family again. And I'm not going to see my buddies again. And I went through boot camp and volunteered with. I couldn't get that out of my mind.
Well, and you mentioned a couple times being in the hospital. I'm sure people are saying, hospital? Well, what put them in the hospital? What happened? Tell us a story. What is that story? What happened?
Okay, what happened was, I don't want to blame it on somebody, but somebody in my outfit, we dug foxholes. And somebody in my outfit, when they started bombardment, they had 88s miles away that were beltering the beach. Someone went into the foxhole that I made. And I looked, and I wasn't going to jump on him. And I just went ahead about 5-6 feet. And all of a sudden, there was an explosion. And I heard a bang on my helmet. And then I went down, and I had a concussion.
Did it knock you unconscious?
Dazed, because I didn't want to go. I said, I'm not going. And my commanding officer says, you are going. I know the medic stuck a flashlight in front of my eyes, and obviously he didn't like what he saw, and he says, you are going.
Well, I don't want to be melodramatic, but I'm just thinking about that moment. And you don't know how big a piece of shrapnel hit you, but
I don't know what hit me. My commanding officer said it was shrapnel all over the place.
Well, and I guess it hit you in the right spot, right?
Yeah, all I had was a big dent on my helmet, and it took a lot to dent that helmet.
And if you didn't have the helmet, it would have killed you.
I would have been dead.
Well, and even if you had the helmet, but that was a few inches lower?
I don't know what would have happened. I would have been knocked out for sure. Here I was in the daze. Then when I got on a ship to take me to the, it was an English hospital that taken over by the United States Army, they said I slept for 12 hours.
And you said that was the time when you're sitting in that hospital that your mind started to comprehend some of what you'd been doing?
Yeah, I knew right then and there that I said, I'm not going to see my family again. I'm not going to see my buddies again.
But you chose to rejoin your buddies when they told you you don't have to. Tell me what happened there.
They told me, they said, we could put you on a hospital ship and you go back to the United States. And I said, no, I know that we were preparing. We didn't know where we were preparing for another landing. I says, they're going to leave for Italy and train there. So I want to be there when they leave for Italy.
So you were gone from the unit for how long?
I was in the hospital for 8 days.
Was anybody surprised to see you when you came back?
My commanding officer said, I was in an Army uniform. They took my fatigues away. And the only thing that left me was with combat boots. And they burnt everything else. So they gave me an Army uniform, which was 10 sizes too big for the little guy I was. And the nurses went ahead and pinned it up for me and did everything. The blouse came down to my knees. And then they gave me free tickets on a train to go to Plymouth, Southern England. I got on that train, and this I remember vividly. The people were buying sandwiches and tea, which was the English drink. Two Englishmen came over to me, and they said, "Here are sandwiches on us." And at that time, I had tears in my eyes, and I wasn't that kind of guy. Rarely did I get tears in my eyes.
If you followed the 80th anniversary events in England and France this week, chances are you shed a few tears too. And there may be more of that to come today. Up next, hear what it was like to jump behind enemy lines on the longest day. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in light of the 80th anniversary of D-Day. For the World War II vets who traveled to Normandy to mark the occasion, there were so many unforgettable moments, including the dedication of a new statue in the town of Saint-Mère-Église, where paratrooper John Steele once pretended to be dead and his parachute caught on the church steeple there. The new statue honors General Dwight Eisenhower and includes text from his exhortation to the troops at the outset of Operation Overlord.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
That great and noble undertaking 80 years ago is a big reason we're all free today. And now let's hear from a couple of the men Ike was talking to. Two of the more than 13,000 paratroopers who would jump behind enemy lines that day. We're going to start with one of the Pathfinders. There were only 300 of them, specially equipped and specially trained to lead the way for the rest of them. Becoming a Pathfinder was never something Maynard Beamy Beamesdurfer set out to do.
Well, I met my uncle over there, and both being from the country of, like, I mean, the cities we were at and speaking. We just sat there and we were speaking Pennsylvania Dutch. And some officer was sitting in back of us, and I didn't know who he was. So he walked around the front after we were done. He says, "Are you Mr. B, Mr.?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You report to headquarters." I said, "Wonder, I was in trouble a couple of times, but I didn't know what I did wrong this time." And I found out later, they pulled me out of headquarters and they sent us into the pathfinding area. Well, we trained there with the 9th Air Force for quite a while. We weren't allowed to talk to anybody outside that darn fence. And we did a lot of night jumping, and they brought us right back in and kept us in this closed area all the time. So that's how I became a pathfinder.
And for people who aren't familiar, what's the difference between a pathfinder and any other paratrooper in the 101st or 82nd?
There's not that much difference. We had just some, maybe a little bit more sand tables, and we had to learn how to use homing devices and different, we call them the old scarf that we put down as markers. The most of the thing was memory and knew the area we were going in were imposed to be setting up where other fellows were coming in.
Well, and that's what I was getting at. Your job was a little different than theirs, and their jobs in many ways depended on how well you did your job, right?
Well, we think we did our job because we were pretty lucky. There was only a little over 300 of us that trained on the Pathfinders, and we didn't have too bad a plane ride going in like some of these fellows did, because we came in around, and I came down close to Carrington, and it was a little wet there because we came in water.
And I always say June 6th, but for you it was really June 5th, wasn't it?
We only went in there anywhere from an hour to 3 hours ahead of time. It all depends what unit left the field, and we had to hurry up and set up this stuff and hope we did a good job for it.
So tell us what your duties were, and were you anxious as you get ready for this big day? I'm sure you're focused on what you're doing. You're not maybe conscious of how massive an operation this is.
We really didn't know what we were getting into for sure. Some of us were pretty darn scared going across. We thought we were super people, but you could see when you looked at some of the guys, they were kind of breaking down a little bit. Our job was to try to set up the best we could for our fellow buddies that were coming in. And then our second job was to hope the engineers that were coming in with a special plane, they had the equipment. There was two dikes that where the bridges were, where that held the water back. And if we couldn't knock those out, that was our second job, to help to show them where these spots were. We were using a new type of material, which I didn't know about, but the stuff was more powerful than we realized. So we had to help them to go in there and set this stuff up. And when they did, they set it off, they set us in the air, because the stuff was that powerful, it just knocked us around.
So the explosion knocked you back, knocked you in the air.
I didn't have no wounds from it. I had bad scratches and cuts, but it affected my ear razors and my bleeding from my mouth and stuff like that, because the pressure, you just don't realize how much pressure that stuff can do to you and how it throws you around. Then our job was we were right close to Carrington. Carrington was the main headquarters for all the German equipment. We tried to knock it out, I don't know how many times, and we lost so many men. And what happened after that, American or British command decided it was impossible to take it. So they bombed that place day and night, the English by night and Americans by day. The way they told us, they started from the outside and moved in. And we finally got into Carrington. There was just nothing left of that place. And what happened to the people? We seen a lot of dead Germans laying around and a lot of cattle and things like that, but we don't know what happened to all the people. We never did find out. But on the 50th anniversary, I was back, and that was the most beautiful city again you could ever see. It was all redone, and they had a big museum there, and they had us about maybe 4 hours going through the museum.
Can you talk about the American losses trying to take Carrington? Did you lose some friends there?
I lost most of my friends. On the Pathfinders, out of our 12 that went in with the one group, we lost 8 of them. Because when we landed there, we landed in a little bit of water, and we had to go to another spot because you can't set up equipment in water. We knew the Germans were all around us because there was a big barn that was burning. And we heard this firing over our heads and stuff until later on. It got worse and worse all the time. We knew they were getting close, and if we couldn't depend on our troops that were coming in, we were told our chances of ever coming out of it would be almost impossible. They all start coming in, and we were mighty happy because they had got stronger, and after many days, they finally taken, as I told you, taken Carrington, what was left of it. We stayed in that area until, I think it was July 14th, they moved us back to England.
When you go in with a group of 12 guys and 8 of them are killed, and you're one of the 4 left standing, is it hard not to think I might be next?
As I said, you're scared. Believe it or not, sometimes you don't control your bowels for being so scared. Yes, I was really worried, but I always carried a New Testament in my pocket, which my mother told me to always carry. And if that helped me through, I don't know. But I didn't have no bad cuts or wounds or bullet wounds, but I was cut up pretty bad. And I had concussion, but concussion don't give you a Purple Heart. Later on, back in England, we were given a special award for the ones that went in as Pathfinders. It's the English wings, just like we, the 3 of us, received the Canadian wings because the Canadians do their jumping here. So we got the gold wings here from Canadians, and I got the gold wings from England. But our training started all over when we got back. I was no longer a Pathfinder then. I moved to a Company H in the 3rd Battalion, and I was moved up in rank a little. Our training started all over, but our groups weren't the same because H Company took a pretty hard licking. The 82nd and the 101st lost a lot of men, fought hard, in the belief that we knew we were doing the right thing.
The late Beamy Beamesdorfer, one of D-Day's Pathfinders. If you go to El Paso, Texas, you'll find the building that airborne veterans gather in today is now named in his honor. And you'll also find photos of his friend, Angel Romero, who jumped on D-Day with the 82nd Airborne Division's 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
We were supposed to have jumped in a little town called Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. We were supposed to capture a bridge there. I wound up landing in a little town called St. Martin. We call it St. Martin. They call it San Martin. It's got another name on it, but it was real close to the beach. It would be about 10 to 12 miles from where we were supposed to land.
So what went wrong? Pilot error or disorientation or what?
All of the ones that you mentioned, everything went wrong, and actually everything went right. If we had landed where we were supposed to have landed, they would have annihilated us within 2 days. And as it was, we were confused, but the Germans were more confused because they had no idea how many had jumped. They reported at least 10 airborne divisions had jumped. It was to our advantage that was such a big mix-up.
The confusion worked in your favor. So what kind of conditions did you face, and when did you encounter the enemy?
Very soon after landing, like I said, we were very close to the beach, so just about as soon as we landed, there were some firefights, and there was a lot of running going back and forth, and maybe about 10, 12 minutes after we landed, there were 3 plane loads from the 101st that landed, almost on top of us. So nobody knew where to go, and there was a labor camp close to where we were, and I could understand some words that were being said in the labor camp. So I started talking in Spanish, and it was very, very difficult. Years later on, I found out that they spoke Catalan, but some words were in Spanish, and I asked them where St. Mary Glees was, and one of them said, way in the back, said, La Iglesia Santa Maria, in Spanish. So I said, yes, and then somebody opened the gate there, and we started talking with them. As much as I could understand, it was very difficult. I couldn't understand much. And they told us which way to St. Mary Glees. I've never been to St. Mary Glees, and I've never been to Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. Never made it.
Sometimes God's plans are a little bit different than the way we or the military envision things working out. Were you scared? Did you feel the ever-present danger around you?
Not before. Like I said, we were trained mentally. And even after landing, I wasn't scared. The first time that I felt any type of fear was whether I could keep up with my comrades or not. That was my biggest fear then. And then, of course, encountering the snipers. They'd fire one shot, and we didn't know where it was coming from. And then it soaked in that you see your first buddy get shot or wounded, and you understand what it's all about. And then you realize that you're in something very, very different.
When was the first time that you were hit?
When it was the first time that I was wounded? It was on the 14th of June in a little town called Etienneville, right at the end of the hedgerows. And I was shot in the leg. We were hedge-hopping each other. We were actually running from the Germans, and there was eight of us. And one would run, and the other seven would fire, and so on, until we got away from them. I don't remember being shot because, like I said, we were running. I remember falling backwards and running. Quite a while later, we were in that little town, in a little church. We sat down, and one of the guys took off all of his equipment, started playing Boogie Woogie and a piano there. And the guy next to me said, "What happened to your leg?" I said, "Nothing." "Why?" He said, "Look at it." And that's when it hurt. But I hadn't felt anything until then.
You think it was just the degree of mental intensity required to do what you were doing that kept you from feeling that pain?
Probably in part, and probably the excitement that was going on, the fear of getting shot, that we were outnumbered and we were outrunning them. No time to think about anything except survival, I guess. That's part of it.
And every D-Day paratrooper like Angel Romero who survived spent the rest of his days honoring and remembering those who didn't come home. So many powerful videos out of Normandy this past weekend from the cemeteries, with a few surviving veterans making sure those whose lives were cut short 80 years ago will never be forgotten. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, another man who landed behind enemy lines on D-Day in his powerless glider. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5000. 383328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special edition in honor of the 80th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy. We're going to have one more D-Day themed episode next week, including some exciting new ways in which technology is keeping that World War II history alive. When it comes to the contribution of gliders on June 6, 1944, there's nowhere better to explore that history than Lubbock, Texas, and the Silent Wings Museum. Established there because that's where so many glider pilots trained before heading overseas, as we hear from one of those men who flew a powerless aircraft into Normandy on June 6, 1944, Morris Bennett.
Lubbock, Texas was going to be the main training base for combat gliders. We got to Lubbock, and they said, well, we got too many here to train at the same time, so everybody's going to have to go through engineering school at Wichita Falls, Texas. And that is how to put the gliders together, how to manufacture them, repair them.
And for people that aren't familiar with it, what are these gliders made out of?
They're made out of tubing and plywood and plexiglass, and covered with fabric, which was dope that they used to use in making model airplanes. So they were just the same idea, what they call dope on the fabric, and that would make it reinforce them. So we had to graduate from there, and then we went back to Lubbock, and we took our advanced training there. And that was the fall of 43, and I graduated from Lubbock in December of 43.
So we're still a little more than 6 months away from D-Day here, and you would spend some of that time undergoing ground warfare training like an infantryman or artilleryman would. They had you ferrying gliders from base to base around the country, and then one day they tell you, you've got to go to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for some special training. I'm sure you had no idea how significant this was going to become. Tell me what you remember about that.
We went on down to Fort Bragg, and we was there about 10 days, took special training. We weren't told what our mission was going to be, but we knew we were going to go to Europe. And we got to Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we was given all our shots, and I issued special ammunition, special guns, special revolvers, and special watches. And we sat there for about a week. In the meantime, what had happened, in Europe, the weather had changed, so they had to change the invasion date for Normandy. I know we were slated to be dropped way behind the lines, this fellows that was doing this type of work for reconnaissance or take some special deal. They never did tell us what it was, but with the equipment we had and the shots we had, we knew we was going to be on something special. But anyway, they called that mission off. Sent us to Boston, and we went, instead of flying us over where we were supposed to go, or the roads that we went across on a troop ship, which was took 3 or 4 days, and I joined the 439th Group and the 94th Squadron of Troop Carrier, which had been in England about 6 or 7 weeks, something like that. We knew that invasion was coming very shortly, so we had to carry full packs and run for every day. And so we got there and they didn't have enough American gliders, so I had to fly a English glider, a Horsa glider, and the Normandy. And I went on June 6th, in other words, just a breaking day probably. We was on double daylight saving. It was probably 4 o'clock in the morning. We took off from our base, and I had just had paratroopers is what we had instead of glider fighters, which normally glider infantry is what we normally would carry. But they had put paratroopers in these gliders, and they didn't like, they'd rather jump than ride a glider. The Horsa, a British glider, will hold 30 people, plus the pilot and the co-pilot. And we had gas masks, so we didn't know what we would have. So we were one of the few gliders that landed intact in Normandy. And we landed, like I say, it was just breaking day. Pro ships had already been in and flown paratroopers in and dropped them about 4 hours before we went, and they came back to England, refueled, tied up on the gliders, and when they would take us off, we were Cliff Mueller, which passed away a few years ago. He was and I flew together, and we were in the air. Cliff was on in the first pilot seat, and I was in the other one, and we couldn't get the nose wheel up. The tow ship was already in the air. Normally, the tow ship is still on the ground, and we were in the air. But you could see the exhaust, because this was dark. You could see the blue coming out of the exhaust, and we were still on the ground. We were about ready to cut off and land in the ocean, and we went ahead and made the deal. We were back about, I think we was 45 or 40. There were usually 50 gliders in a stick, what we call a group. Each group would have a deal, and takes about 45 minutes to make the group together to come back in a formation. And they're four abreast, just staggered four across.
Well, and it seems to me, and again, a lot of people might have no knowledge of gliders at all, so they probably want to know, What were the tow ships? How did you guys get airborne? What?
Normally on the Orsa glider, they were towed by the British four-engine Fairfax bombers. But our C-47s or DC-3s, which are, some people call them one thing, some people call them something else, they were able to tow a horse, a glider, or two CG-4 gliders on twin tow, which we flew later on, but not on Normandy, which was just a single tow on, or even on the CG-4s. Like on takeoff, when we couldn't hear about 10 years ago, Cliff came by and visited me one day, and he says, "I guess you know you saved my life." And I said, "Why is that?" He says, "Don't you recall telling those paratroopers to some of them get back on the plane a little bit so we get the nose wheel off?" And I said, "No, I don't remember." And he says, "Well, I sure as hell did."
You had to rebalance the plane, huh?
Yeah, I'd balance it up to get, that's how come we was able to go ahead and get off. Otherwise, we would.
You never would have gotten off the ground.
In other words, we would end in the ocean. And with these 30 guys behind us, that's much aid in this thing. And we weren't that really good horse or pilots because we hadn't flown that in a horse that much. The CG-4, in other words, I could have done a lot more with it, but they were not with that thing.
You spent over a year training to fly one kind of glider. Then on the biggest day of your life, you end up in a glider you've never flown before, and you're going to end up in the English Channel, and you're all going to sink in the ocean if you didn't make that adjustment, huh? Where do you think that came from? What clicked in your mind to ask them to do that?
I don't know. It just wasn't coming off. We said we got to get some weight in the back end up to get the nose up. I don't know. It's just one of them things that you do.
What was your mission, and how did it unfold?
Normandy, in other words, we landed, like I say, about daylight. We got to the CP. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning, which was a command post where the 101st troopers, paratroopers, and with St. Mary Galice is where the town was that we landed, and that's where the CP was in an apple orchard. As soon as we got there, in other words, I told the glider pilots, in other words, you head back for the beach. Your mission is done for this deal. Go back to the beach and you fly another mission. So we started back, walking back. Some people rode a bicycle or most of you walking. There was about 15 of us got a Jeep that had been wrecked earlier. We got on it and then got back to the beachhead. And the tanks were coming in by this time. It was probably 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. One of the tank commanders says, "Get that pile of junk out of the road." And we just drove off the side of the road and off the sand dune and walked on the rest of the way in. And then they said, "Well, these guys have all lost their guns and everything coming in. So stack your guns and ammunition over there. And these other fellows have lost theirs on the landing. They've got something to work with." And they said, "Get on this landing craft and go out to this British cruiser that has shot its guns out on the earlier landing, they were earlier that morning, they're going back to Britain." So by 9 o'clock, I was on this cruiser, and the next morning, I was back in England. And I got a three-day pass because, in other words, everything worked all right, and I didn't have to go back on another mission on that one.
But I'm sure there's a lot more to that day than what you just shared with us. You take off from England, and you are going over the English Channel, being towed by these bigger planes. What did you see? Did you see a bunch of other gliders? Did you see bombers everywhere? Did you see ships down below? Paint a picture for us.
Thousands of all types of battleships. The Navy was, there was the landing. In other words, we could see the firing. In other words, ahead of us where we were headed. And as the tow ships went in earlier, as I was said, earlier, in other words, they dropped the paratroopers, and then so when the tow pilots got close to where the anti-aircraft fire was coming up to us, in other words, they already had turned, and they'd be going straight ahead on us, but they'd already turned, and it was off to our left. It was almost quarter degrees from where they should have been, and so we kept going as far as we could till we cut loose, and we seen a field that we could land in that didn't have the telephone poles, what they call the Rommel's asparagus, and the hedgerows is what got most of us. We had no idea that they briefed us on the hedgerows, but they didn't tell us that the hedgerows are full of rocks, which was maybe 10, 15, 20 foot wide and 10 or 15 foot high. And that's what most of the gliders ran into. In other words, that landed, the crash stop was hitting the trees and the hedgerows.
So I'm going to ask you some dumb questions here, just because this is not something most of us are familiar with. When you say you cut loose, how do you do that? How do you get the glider loose from the tow?
You just hit a lever, and it drops the ring out of the tow ship, out of the glider, and that's it. And the tow ship can cut you loose, too, because they could do the same thing. They could do the same thing. They're supposed to have somebody watching the glider all the time, but sometimes they didn't do it.
So on this one, June 6th, you pull that lever, you're on your own. You've got 30 paratroopers in your plane with you and a co-pilot. You're responsible for all these lives. You're on the most intense day of battle in world history, basically, is what you're facing here. You get a little adrenaline rush there. What was going through your mind as you cut loose and realized, here we go?
You don't realize that the people behind you there, in other words, you just go ahead and do what you were trained to do, and you do it automatically. You find a place that you could get in and land and try to get down in one piece is what's the biggest thing that you try to do on that type of thing.
And could you see the artillery and the ships below firing away at everything, or no?
Oh, yes. You can see the fighting on the ground. But we're only 500 feet, so you're not going to see very much. We come in and land at a close, about 500 foot is what we come in and land in. It wasn't like the originally flew up high and cut loose and circled and come down. In other words, they pulled you in right close to where you're going to drop off.
Well, that seems to me like it would make it worse, because there's even less margin for error when you come in at 500 feet. So what did you see, and how did you know where to go and where to land? And were you scared at all? Because I'd be scared out of my mind.
Well, in other words, we were briefed about these fields being flooded with water. Of course, you knew it wouldn't be very deep. I could see a cut in the trees where there was an open deal and a little field beyond that. And if you were good at what you were doing, you was able to get into it. And we figured we'd get into it, and we did. All we did was knock the nose wheel off when we hit one little ditch across the coast. You couldn't tell from the air by a little ditching, but we knocked the nose wheel off, and otherwise it was landed right up where we're supposed to be. And everybody got off. There were a few of them sick, but...
Okay, so now you're coming in. You fly in over the beaches where all this fierce fighting is happening, and you're supposed to land behind enemy lines. You don't really have a way out of there other than your 2 feet. How do you know where you're going, and how do you think you're actually going to make it out of this alive? You know there's a war going on.
It depended on the guys that you had with us, in other words, the troopers, because they were more advanced than we just followed the boards. We were just a trooper then. After we got on the ground, we were just whatever the, maybe he was a first sergeant or somebody else. He says, in other words, like the band of brothers, you come on with me and you go, we'll get back to where we're supposed to go. We knew we was going to be the same as at least we knew about where we were, but not exactly.
Did you have any idea? I mean, obviously your own life is in jeopardy here, but did you have any idea of what those paratroopers would be up against with the kind of fighting they were going to face?
No, I don't think any of us really knew what was going to be the up against. It was one of those things that everything worked out good for me.
Was that landing? Were you anxious? Were you nervous?
No, I wasn't. Just like no different than flying in Indianapolis when I would come in and land in where I was supposed to be, or the first time when I ran out of gas. I had another one when I was in training, in other words, on ferry. In other words, the tow ship, the glider came loose from the tow ship. They didn't make a good connection with the tow ship. And I was over out of St. Louis in the Ozarks. Everybody and all the farmers in little towns in the woods in the Ozarks, they come looking. Here was an 85-foot airplane in our backyard. And it had been snowing, so there was probably about 3 or 4 foot of snow on the ground. But I flew a pattern in, and I seen a little hump in the snow, and I figured that was a fence, and sure enough it was. So I just got over it and sat down, and I dug in the snow, and I flew up to this guy's barn, landed right close to his barn. They took us in the house and fed us biscuits and bacon, and boy, really had a real good meal. And pretty soon the constable came, which is the law enforcement they had on the new Model A car, and he took us to the little bus stop. And I had a telephone now, and I called the base, and they said, oh, we already know that your tow ship circled you and said you were down okay. So, but the tow rope had come loose from the glider. We never did anything, so we just left it there, and the Army sent in a ground crew and picked it up.
Well, in the snow by St. Louis, they're waiting for you with bacon and biscuits. But on June 6th, when you put that thing down, was there concern that enemy forces might be nearby?
Oh, yes. We knew they were ground people because we'd seen them. The dead fellows already there where the paratroopers had already been fighting with them on our way to the CP. And we knew that they were being shot at every once in a while then. So we took the hedgerows the roads along the hedgerows, and we'd be in the ditches. We stayed in the ditches like that until when we were strung out maybe 10 to 15 feet apart, protecting each other, till we got to the CP. And then on the way back home, it was in that Jeep. In other words, we got come under sniper fire for a while, but we took care of the 17 of us, took care of him, and then we went on our way back to the beachhead.
And did you have any special instructions for what you were to do with the glider after you landed it?
Just leave it.
I know, I'm sure you've told these stories before, but you describe it so matter-of-factly, and it sure seems intimidating to me to land a glider behind enemy lines and have to work your way back, not knowing where the enemy is, to be shot at by snipers, all of this stuff that you've never experienced before, and you're just a young kid. What do you think it was that helped you get through that and helped you believe you could?
I don't know. It's just the way that, I suppose, the way that I was raised, in other words, and worked on. My dad was killed when I was 1930, so I was 8 years old in an automobile accident, a foggy morning at Hanford. And so I lived with my grandfather and my uncles, and they did taught me all the things that I needed to know to survive.
They must have taught you pretty well. So you told us how you got back, but even when you get back to that beach and you're supposed to go out to this British ship, what did that beach look like? I mean, was there devastation everywhere?
Well, we were strafed a couple of times. We had to dig into the sand because of the Germans they came and strafed the beach with fighter planes a couple of times, but didn't last very long until our fighters took over, and that was it. They were still firing at that first on the 6th of June at night. That night they were still fighting on the beachhead.
And you got to get off that beach. A landing craft took you to that British ship, but I imagine there are a lot of images from that 24-hour period you simply cannot erase from your memory. What'd you see from the deck of that ship?
I seen this big ship ahead of mine or something, and it was big. It was maybe 200 or 300 or 400 foot long. I mean, a big ship. I don't know whether it was a cruiser or what. But it just went up in the air, and then down I went. And you knew all these guys were on it. Never seen anybody get off of it. So, I mean, that was probably the worst thing that I'd seen as far as of all the other things that happened. And that was just before dark.
The price that was paid on June 6, 1944, and throughout World War II, as so many veterans have expressed in different ways on Hometown Heroes over the years, for it to be truly worth it, it's up to us. So let's live in a way and love our country in a way that assigns a value to our freedom that comes close to matching that incredible price that has been paid. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, underscoring that sentiment one more time for good measure. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.